Private Equity in Healthcare. Another Reason to Become Your Own Doctor by Marinda Teller. If you were to do an internet search on the largest U.S. employers, you would likely be unsurprised by the first two juggernauts, Walmart and Amazon, to pop up on the list. However, such rankings mask the influence of other major behind-the-scenes players, notably the shrouded-in-secrecy private equity, PE, industry. According to one calculation, 7% of the U.S. labor force works for businesses backed by PE, making PE giants like KKR, Kohlberg, Kravis Roberts & Company, Carlyle and Blackstone the third, fourth, and fifth largest U.S. employers, respectively. In fact, as federal prosecutor Brendan Belew explains in his 2023 book, Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America, the PE industry owns more businesses than all those listed on U.S. stock exchanges combined. Private equity and industry with historical roots in the leveraged buyout, LBO, and junk bond free-for-all of the 1980s is a powerful and ubiquitous player in today's financialized economy, having more than doubled in size just between 2019 and 2024. Unfortunately, it remains woefully invisible to many of those most affected by its shenanigans: workers, customers, patients, pensioners, and small businesses. As authors Gretchen Morgenson and Joshua Rosner explain in their own 2023 book about the PE industry and the modern age robber barons who run it, these are the plunderers, how private equity runs and wrecks America. The economic wreckage caused by the takeover titans is real and measurable, except now they call their industry private equity, a name that conveys suave sophistication, but none of its brutality. It is important for members of the public to grasp the private equity game so that they can demand accountability and push back against a business model that the Solari Report's Catherine Austin Fitz characterizes as destructive and even criminal. An extractive model. What is private equity? According to Belew, the simple PE business model operates something like this. Private equity firms invest a little of their own money, a lot of investors' money, and a whole lot of borrowed money to buy up companies, typically making them the sole or private owner, hence the name. They then use various tactics to extract money from those companies with an eye toward reselling them for a profit a few years later. As explained in These Are the Plunderers, PE firms often sicken companies that were previously healthy, loading them with debt while bleeding them of assets and profits. In a January 2026 interview with Fitz, Tiffany Tianzi, a former small business owner whose up-close and personal experience with PE turned her into an expert on the industry, put herself in a hypothetical private equity firm's shoes, offering an example of how the debt would work if the firm, first person I in her example, decided to buy Catherine's Tire Center. If I want to buy Catherine's Tire Center, I'm going to borrow most of the money to do that. I'm never going to owe that money back. Catherine's Tire Center is going to owe that money back. I have no liability whatsoever, even though I retain all decision-making authority. All the leverage is foisted upon Catherine's Tire Center to repay, even though I'm the one that made the decision. My fund is the one that created it. My fund is the one that borrowed it. My fund is the one that convinced the bank. In Belew's definition, extract is the critical verb to pay attention to. Egregiously, as he notes, PE firms start by extracting exorbitant fees from the companies they buy merely for the privilege of being owned by PE. In addition, they often sell off the lucrative and generally paid-off real estate that the purchased companies are sitting on, forcing the business into rent back the very properties they once owned. The Steward Hospital chain had to file for bankruptcy after a sale-leaseback agreement with private equity left it $50 million in arrears on rent payments. Equally cleverly, Morgenson and Rosner explain, the plunderers also arrange to have the entities they buy do business with other companies they own, guaranteeing several streams of income from their investments. In short, PE firms take money from productive companies, their employees, and their customers, and redistribute it to themselves. Not infrequently, as the Steward Hospital story illustrates, the short or medium-term result of a PE takeover is business collapse and bankruptcy. Companies acquired by private equity have bankruptcy rates 10 times higher than for other types of acquisitions, with enormously damaging ripple effects on workers and households, Effects that include not just lost jobs, but loss of health insurance, potential loss of home, and family stress and dislocation. In the first quarter of 2025, 7 out of 10 of the largest bankruptcies, with largest defined as companies with over $1 billion in liabilities, were filed by PE-owned companies, as were 54% of the largest bankruptcies and 11% of all corporate bankruptcies in 2024. Thanks to legal insulation tactics, these bankruptcies not only tend to leave the PE owners untouched, but, says Ballou, can counterintuitively be desirable, even profitable. Following a bankruptcy, it is the PE firm that gets paid first, while employees and small business creditors get the shaft. PE firms can also use bankruptcy as an attractive tax write-off and come out ahead overall. Catherine Austin Fitz describes the bankruptcies as part and parcel of PE's extraction model, saying, "That's not a performance issue, that's a plan." Looking back at 2020, let's recall that the forced shutdowns of non-essential businesses were a disaster for Main Street, resulting in the disproportionate failure of the small businesses that are the job creators and dynamic engines of a productive economy. Instead, America witnessed a sharp concentration of market share among larger businesses, including those owned by private equity, while non-PE-backed firms struggled to obtain additional financing and stay afloat, resulting in a higher incidence of liquidation. The so-called pandemic was a bonanza for private equity. Not only did the PE industry fare well, going on a bargain basement shopping spree, buying up distressed businesses, while thrusting the knife even deeper into the suffering workforce by aggressively cutting costs at the new acquisitions, PE billionaires' personal wealth also surged, beginning in the pandemic's earliest months. By October 2021, a year that Forbes enthusiastically characterized as stellar and record-breaking, 21 leading private equity billionaires were worth a combined $154 billion. As of 2025, the finance and investment sector that includes private equity remained the dominant billionaire factory, responsible for the wealth of 15.3% of all billionaires, even surpassing the tech sector, 13.2%. The silent partner, government. During COVID, hospitals and other PE-owned healthcare institutions raked in billions in government payments. This highlights the most important point at the core of Ballou's book, a fact with which Morganson and Rosner fully agree. PE could not thrive without government help. At the most obvious level, this should be unsurprising because nearly 9 in 10 members of Congress, 88%, receive campaign donations from private equity, with PE having spent a whopping $150 million on the 2024 elections. An analysis that year found that 26 of the wealthiest senators and representatives from both political parties also had personal PE investments worth over $150 million. Because of limited disclosure requirements, the analysts believe this amount to be almost certainly a significant undercount. Ballou comments about government involvement in private equity. "The stunning success of private equity is all happening with the support of the government, whose various arms have not only allowed private equity to grow and dominate, but have actively encouraged it. When it comes to the federal government, not only has it been extraordinarily solicitous of PE firms, including dropping major lawsuits about PE ripoffs of federal money on the eve of trial and abandoning whistleblowers to their fate, but it actually subsidizes private equity's depredations in a variety of ways. The government gravy train," explain Morganson and Rosner, "includes subsidies, contracts, federal loans, loan guarantees, bailouts, tax loopholes, and more. And nowhere is the ignominy of this unacknowledged public-private partnership more apparent than in private equity's devastating incursions into healthcare. Full-throttle assault on healthcare. Private equity's reach extends from cradle to grave," note Morganson and Rosner, "with its tentacles entering sectors ranging from pre-K learning centers to rental housing, to podcasts, to online betting, to supermarkets. For nearly three decades, however, healthcare and hospitals have been particular PE magnets, with private equity playing an instrumental role in reshaping and restructuring the healthcare industry. According to some estimates, the PE industry has spent $1 trillion on healthcare acquisitions since 2000. In the U.S., as of April 2025, PE owned nearly 1 in 10 private hospitals, 9%, and almost 1 in 4 proprietary for-profit hospitals, 23%. 23% of PE-owned hospitals, as of last year, were psychiatric facilities, and at least 28% served rural populations. Again, illustrating the silent partnership with government, rural hospitals apparently make especially attractive PE targets because most of their funding comes from Medicaid and Medicare, which guarantees a level of income. Alongside ownership of hospitals, PE has invaded emergency departments, EDs, a push facilitated by a lot of regulatory cracks in the system. Nationally, a recent study estimated that 1 in 4 ED visits takes place in emergency departments staffed by private equity, and in some states, the PE market share for ED visits exceeds 30%. Other long-standing PE favorites include ambulance services, nursing homes, outpatient physician practices, with a 600% increase in PE takeovers of physician-owned practices from 2012 to 2021, urgent care, ambulatory surgery centers, maternal health, home care services, rehabilitation services, hospices and specialties ranging from dermatology to dentistry. In recent years, PE has branched out to other fast-growing and niche market segments, scooping up fertility clinics, health information technology companies, clinical trial entities, autism therapy centers, and medical billing and debt collection services, euphemistically called revenue cycle management, or RCM. According to the nonprofit watchdog group Private Equity Stakeholder Project, PSP, PE's entry into the RCM arena has led to more aggressive debt collection efforts, as well as attempts to collect wrong amounts or even debts that are not owed at all. By all accounts, PE ownership has ravaged healthcare institutions and significantly lowered the quality of care they provide. This is documented in a growing number of publications, and even medical insiders are appalled. A retired professor of medicine wryly suggests that private equity's goal, facilitated by ample financial resources and arcane financial engineering strategies, has been to maximize profits by manipulating the fiscal opportunities in the management of business dealings surrounding care, without providing any actual care for patients. More bluntly, the current president of the American Academy of Emergency Medicine, Vicky Norton, MD, has stated that while PE firms' clear goal, maximize profits above all else, may not be in and of itself evil, when you mix it into healthcare, it is inherently evil. As if to bear out Norton's statement, a study published in 2025 announced that after private equity acquires a hospital, the emergency room Medicare population experiences 13% increased mortality compared to the death rate before the acquisition. Morganson and Rosner put it this way: while the impact of private equity on industries tends to be negative, in healthcare it can be deadly. Critics argue that private equity's presence in the healthcare arena has also resulted in more expensive services. One study found that from 1 year to the next, 2017 to 2018, Americans spent 4.6% more on healthcare, but they did so due to higher prices, not because they were going to the doctor or hospital more often. Cost-cutting actions that PE owners commonly take after an acquisition include cutting inpatient staffing and slashing salaries so that fewer and less well-paid staff have to care for more patients, pressuring outpatient clinicians to increase daily patient volumes, substituting less skilled staff, such as replacing a doctor with a physician's assistant or full-time employees with contractors, not keeping up with equipment needs or using shoddier supplies and equipment, reducing training and supervision, hospitalizing patients unnecessarily, over-ordering diagnostic tests and procedures, or ordering more costly tests than required, booking patients for treatments they don't need, demanding more aggressive coding on insurance claims, using surprise medical billing as a business model, that is, billing patients at out-of-network rates when services were delivered at an in-network facility, providing loans via medical credit cards, high-interest payment plans, and strategic partnerships with financial service providers that trap patients in unpayable medical debt. The net effect of these cost-cutting and revenue-boosting measures is that assets once used for patient care are transferred to investor profits, leaving behind a medical practice or hospital less able to provide medical care to patients. As a physician observes, Cutting corners to gain a competitive advantage is inherent in the PE strategy. This leads to dangerous mistakes and shortfalls for patients, including, for example, medication errors, poor management of bed sores, unskilled performance of critical procedures, and, for more debilitated patients or nursing home residents, withdrawal or unavailability of assistance with eating and personal hygiene. Assisted reproduction takeover. One out of every 37 babies born in the U.S. is conceived using an assisted reproductive technology, ART, such as in vitro fertilization, IVF, with the number of ART births increasing by 23% between 2020 and 2022. This growth has attracted private equity's attention, as Spanish assisted reproduction expert A.A. Zade explains. The fragmented yet resilient fertility industry combines steady revenue streams with significant growth potential. The industry anticipates growth due to trends such as delayed family planning, high self-pay rates, increasing demand from LGBTQ+ individuals, and IVF profitability. The strong private pay component ensures an attractive reimbursement profile. The industry anticipates consistent demand, helping to make it recession-resistant. Thus, as of 2023, over 32% of U.S. fertility clinics were private equity affiliated, double the proportion owned by PE in 2018, and those clinics carried out 54% of all in vitro fertilization cycles versus 29% of IVF cycles 5 years earlier. Zade also notes that PE ownership increases pressure to promote add-on treatments that often are medically obsolete, lacking robust evidence of clinical benefit, yet highly profitable. He comments that while pushing add-ons is not exclusive to PE clinics, the scale and aggressiveness of their promotion have significantly increased under PE ownership, where commercial teams, rather than clinicians, often drive the inclusion of such treatments in the clinic's portfolio. He concludes, "The controversy lies not in the existence of these add-ons, but in how they are marketed, incentivized, and presented to patients." Another emerging niche, clinical trials. In late 2025, the Private Equity Stakeholder Project, PSEP, warned that private equity is now moving into the clinical trial industry, with clinical trial sites considered among the most sought-after segments of the pharmaceutical services industry. A worried PSEP points out that private equity involvement in clinical research could reshape how medical studies are conducted and overseen, and that growing consolidation of research sites raises concerns about trial safety and long-term impacts on patients. According to PESP, two PE-backed firms also control much of the Institutional Review Board, IRB process, that is an essential step in evaluating whether proposed research in humans is ethically acceptable. As of 2021, the two PE-backed IRBs reviewed fully 92% of all drug trials overseen by independent IRBs, a concentration, PSEP comments, that could compromise objectivity. When one of the PE-backed IRB firms approved a trial for an Alzheimer's drug, it used a secrecy provision to circumvent certain aspects of informed consent. And the result was disastrous. The drug ended up causing brain bleeding or swelling in 37% of participants and killed two of them. No exit? Until now, the general pattern has been for PE firms to hold companies for an average of 10 years and then sell the companies off. Increasingly, however, they are having trouble exiting. For a variety of complex reasons, they are currently choking on their portfolios and, according to Tiffany Chianci, sitting on a $4 trillion backlog. Even the mainstream financial press and other media are now pointing to worries about rot in the private equity industry. Fitz and Chianci suggest that this is prompting the PE industry to invent new shenanigans. Chianci comments, "I don't know a better way to explain it than they've run out of ways to cash out. Every single vehicle they've used isn't working. And so now, it's just whoever can come up with the newest thing that's not illegal yet." One of the newest things is a Ponzi scheme-type practice called continuation funds. Continuation funds allow PE to hold on to assets beyond the typical fund term and, instead of selling the assets to third parties, sell them to their own newly established fund, that is, to themselves. As the authors of a University of Chicago Business School paper wrote in January 2024, in surprisingly honest terms, The strategy raises a labyrinth of concerns about conflicts of interest that cast a shadow on continuation funds' growing prevalence. Unfortunately, as the business school authors wrote, the house always wins is a major part of private equity managers' incentives. In August 25, the PE house won in a big way with a new executive order signed by President Trump that allows 401ks to invest in alternative assets that include PE, a move that augments the already sizable risks that retirees face from underperforming state pension funds' incautious devil's bargain with private equity. These undesirable macro-level developments do not mean that ordinary people are powerless to push back. In the face of private equity's shaky stranglehold on business and investment, Fitz and Tianzi have one ready answer. Stop investing in and spending money on unproductive and extractive entities and redirect your investments and spending toward productive, high-integrity entities that build real wealth, including the local businesses where you live. As Tianzi explains, every time a private equity firm acquires a business in your community, 94% of the money you give that company leaves your community and never comes back. But if you support a small business in your community, that small business keeps 68 to 74 cents of every dollar in your community. It stays in your town. Individuals with pension funds and 401ks should also call their fund administrators and make it clear that they want their investments to be private equity free. When it comes to healthcare, a simple solution is likewise available. Stay healthy so that you do not have to interface with an untrustworthy healthcare system. The Weston A. Price Foundation and Wise Traditions offer numerous resources, including a helpful article by Dr. Andrew Kaufman that describes how to stay out of the emergency room. And let's be honest, the pharma-dominated healthcare system that private equity has run roughshod over was never all that safe or health-promoting to begin with. Sidebars: the poisoning business model. Families victimized by vaccine injury and other forms of medical harm have begun to understand that medical poisoning is a business model. Private equity's timely entry into autism services illustrates that PE too understands the model. Pharmaceutical companies poison children, cause neurological damage, and create a market for services to manage the damage, while private equity buys up the industry providing those services. Catherine Austin Fitz also speculates that private equity's careful advance positioning in hospitals and other critical healthcare infrastructure may have been a necessary, or at least helpful, ingredient facilitating the medically unethical and murderous practices that took place in hospitals during COVID. Why do they sell? Given the often disastrous patient and business outcomes that follow a private equity acquisition, one could be forgiven for wondering, why does anyone sell to PE to begin with? In healthcare, some authors chalk up physicians' sale of their practices to the fact that they were trained to be doctors and healthcare professionals, not business people. As those authors suggest, ongoing financial pressures and heightened contestation over reimbursements by the government and third-party payers have led some providers to view private equity buyouts of their practices as welcome relief. In addition, private equity's cash enticement to doctors can be powerful. Private equity typically pays 15 times the physician's annual income to acquire it entirely. That purchase price may then be taxed at the lower capital gains rate, leaving the physician with a handsome payday and an opportunity to retire early. That observer, General Counsel of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, AAPS, Andrew Schlafly, cautions, however, that there are onerous strings attached and fine print that can make the embrace of private equity the equivalent of jumping out of a frying pan and into a fire.